Well, folks, how are we? Welcome to Best of Belfast, the podcast that celebrates Northern Ireland and the incredible people in it. You've caught us at a pretty interesting wee time here. We are halfway through a five-part mini-series all about climate change called Climate of Change that we're rolling out in partnership with Ulster Bank. And basically, all the other episodes in this series are these kind of highly edited 30-minute productions featuring amazing local entrepreneurs who are doing their bit through their business for the planet. And basically at this kind of Wednesday mark, you know, we're rolling out an episode every single day this week. So we're at the halfway point. You're probably at the halfway point of your week as well. And always like to take things a little bit slower. Always like to move down a gear or two for the Wednesday episodes and put out more of a raw, unfiltered, uncut conversation, just to break the week up and also just share a different kind of style of story. And there was no better story, no better conversation for us to do that than with the conversation you're about to hear with Dr. Lucy Talence. So who is Dr. Lucy Talence? Put simply, she is a conservationist who spent the last 10 years teaching at Oxford before launching her own environmental e-learning startup, Verdant Learn, whose goal is to empower wildlife conservation professionals all over the world. And I just absolutely adored this conversation with Lucy. Honestly, I just found it so fun. I found it very relaxing, yet also incredibly challenging. Don't ask me how the heck that's possible, but it is. And we cover so much ground. So, I mean, so much random stuff as well, like how she's a black belt in shaolin and temple boxing. We talk about her time where she lived up the mountains in Ethiopia, studying wolves as part of her PhD. We also talk about extinction and how it's a very, very real issue that we're facing at an unprecedented rate today. And it was a really interesting deep dive into the world of conservation. You know, it's not something that any of us really know much about other than David Attenborough and that scene from Tarzan. You know, I mean, that was about the height of it for me. And it was really, really interesting to hear about some of the dynamics that are involved there. You know, how that space gets funded, why it's so important. How do you balance colonialism with trying to work with local communities? It's all just so, so, so interesting. It's one of the things I love about doing this podcast. It's one of the things I know that you enjoy about listening to it is the chance just to jump into someone's world. And that's the only way I can describe it. And that's the last thing I'll say before shutting up and getting into this episode with Lucy. It's the chance just to step into another world. One that is full of colour and nature and animals and experiences and adventures. And also one that is filled with some very real challenges that Lucy is now spending this next season of her life to address through the wonderful tool that we call entrepreneurship. So yeah, look, hope you really enjoy. Thanks so much for being here. And please welcome to your ears the wonderful Dr. Lucy Talence.
Yeah, well, my first memory is getting stung by a bee. And so it's possibly a bit surprising that I went into wildlife conservation.
Irony.
But yeah, when I was about four, I was in the school playground, got stung by a bee and I had to have this really horrible yellow stuff put on me on the sting. But yeah, beyond that, like something in my childhood, we moved when I was about nine. We moved out into the countryside. So before that, we were in Kidderminster, quite an industrial town in the Midlands of England. And we moved out into the countryside. And then I just spent a lot of time just outdoors whenever I could, whenever the weather was good. I was a bit of a solitary child, despite being an identical twin. Wow. So we just ended up. I just spent a lot of time outside and enjoying exploring the countryside after not really having had much access to a garden before.
And this is really an on-the-nose question. It's like extremely low-hanging fruit, but like apart from the bee sting, you know, what was kind of your early relationship like with animals and where did that kind of passion come from?
We had pets. When I was younger, like starting off with hamsters and gerbils and then going on to have a cat. We always wanted a dog, but we weren't
allowed
one. You
were trying to promote it up to a dog, never made it.
Yeah, we always wanted one, but my dad grew up on a farm and for him, dogs were working animals and they should stay outside. And
we were like, if they can't pay their rent, they're not welcome.
Exactly. And we were like, no, we want the kind that comes indoors and sleeps on our bed. But no, that wasn't to be. But I joined a birding club when I was young, I guess just preteen or something like that. And we used to go out at the weekend with these expert birders. And I just really enjoyed learning to identify things and putting names on things. I guess, you know, like I'm a scientist, and I think from really early on, I just wanted to know what everything was and understand more about why particular birds behaved a certain way, or what they were doing, what the purpose was of the calls that they were making, and the behaviour that we could see they were doing. And I've just always been really fascinated by the natural world. And again, I think that some of it stems from being quite shy as a child and not necessarily being very good at making friends and kind of retreating in some way into the natural world. But I wouldn't say that's the case anymore. Now I absolutely love being with people and love having conversations. But certainly growing up, books and being outside were my big things. I remember going on a trip to Simmons Yacht and seeing red kites. I think it was one of the few places they were left, or maybe one of the first places that they were reintroduced in England, and just being blown away by how big they were and how close we got to them. And then there was another time I was just out in the back paddock in my parents' house. Again, I was a like young teenager. And suddenly it was dusk, and suddenly this barn owl just flew out of nowhere and perched on a fence. And it was just so beautiful that it just stared at me and then flew off again. And I was completely mesmerized by it. And again, when I was working in the mountains in Ethiopia, this is now when I was doing my PhD research, there was one evening where a huge owl, I can't remember what the species is, I'm afraid, that just shows how much you forget over time. but it just, it was a big horned owl, and it just landed a few metres away from me on the ground and stared at me with these glowing orange eyes, and then launched itself back up into the air. And those moments where you connect, you just kind of look into the eyes of another species, it's just really powerful. And I'm not saying I learned anything in particular from that experience, but it's just that feeling that you're part of something and you have this moment of connection with another species that just, I get a lot of energy from that. And it, I think it's one of the things that informs my belief that humans don't necessarily have primacy in this world, that every other species has a right to live and a right to live undisturbed by us.
There's two little things I have to get out of the way before we kind of move on into the rest of the interview, and I'll let you choose which direction we go first, okay? So two prompts. Certainly. The first one is, I'm not going to be able to pronounce this properly, but I'm just going to say Shalowin Temple Boxing. And then the other one that I'll kind of hang in front of you is time spent with Ethiopian wolves. So choose your own adventure. Where are we going?
Oh, I love it. Let's start with the Shaolin Temple Boxing, which so that's Shirinji Kenpo. It's a Japanese martial art based on Chinese kung fu. And it's something that I started doing back when I was an undergrad, back in the late 90s. And it's something that's really affected the way that I live my life, the way that I approach challenges. And it's been a wonderful thing to be involved in. So when I was back at Oxford doing my undergrad, I obviously went to Freshers Fair back when those things happened face to face. And it was amazing to see how many sports were on offer, how many different activities, and that, you know, you're spoilt for choice. But I was rubbish at sports when I was growing up. I never learned to throw and catch a ball. And I really wanted to do something that would keep me fit, would be interesting, would be something completely different from the studying. Sadly, we live in a world where women feel that they need to do certain things to make themselves feel safe. So I decided, being, you know, living on my own in a city for the first time, I would learn a martial art. And I went round and I talked to people at the various stalls to find out about the different martial arts. And I tried out two or three that seemed to be more on the less competitive side of things, less ego-driven side of things. And I was just really caught up by Shorinji Kenpo. It's based on Buddhist principles. So it's about martial art as self-defense. Certainly that's as a colored belt, like before you get to black belt level, you're thinking about how can I use what I know to protect myself in a difficult situation, but without doing any permanent harm to the other people. You do punches and kicks and joint locks and throws, but they're all designed to focus on pressure points. So you take advantage of the body's natural weak points to exert pressure and use your lesser strength and scientific principles of momentum and leverage and that kind of thing to be able to get the upper hand if someone is attacking you. But as I grew into it and I trained on and off for about 20 years, and sadly I haven't trained recently. I can't find somewhere in Belfast to train, but maybe I should start my own dojo, but that's a whole other
shout
story.
Shout out to all the Shorinji Kenpo people listening. If you're out there, you know, get in touch.
Do. I would love to get back into training. But yeah, as you get more involved in it, as your skills increase, the focus becomes more on reducing conflict that you see, like stopping the fight before it even starts, trying to read a situation and understand when you or other people might be at risk, and using different means, not necessarily a display of power, but sometimes that, to try and stop any conflict situation starting or escalating. And I just got so much out of the physical side of it. It was the only thing that stopped me worrying about studying. It was the only thing that took my mind off my exams when we got into exam season. It was the mental respite from that. I made amazing friends from it. When you're throwing each other around and you're deliberately hurting each other, you have to, you know, build trust very, very quickly. You just develop these really strong bonds and friendships with people. And it gave me courage to put myself into situations that I would normally find quite scary, including this, including recording a podcast. It made me realise that I'm not, that although I can be in pain and stressed, I'm not going to break. I know my limits are much better than I ever did before I started this martial art. And it's given me a lot of confidence I don't think I'd have had otherwise.
Man, I'm glad I asked. That was so
I could talk about it for hours, but that's probably not what your listeners want to hear.
It's so great. No, and look, I'm just going to flex on everyone for a second. Lucy is actually a black belt in Shorinji Kenpo, so, you know, don't mess with her. Speaking of courage, Ethiopian wolves, not for the faint of heart. Tell us about that.
Well, they're actually not scary. Well, they don't eat large animals, so they're different from grey wolves in that they don't chase after big prey, not very often. They don't tend to hunt in a pack. They eat rats, so they eat rodents. They live up in the very high mountains in Ethiopia, up on in the montane grasslands up above the tree line. They're highly endangered. They will probably go extinct because of climate change, if not within my lifetime, then within my son's lifetime. And you could probably hear me welling up at that because it's something I feel very emotional about. Extinction is painful to me, especially of such a beautiful species that is unique and that I have a strong emotional connection to from having run around in the mountains trying to keep up with them at high altitude, gasping for breath for 2 years of my life. But yeah, so I had the opportunity to do a PhD with Oxford University on Ethiopian wolf ecology and behaviour to try and understand a little bit more about how they interact with the landscape and the rodents and the people and the livestock that are encroaching into their grasslands. And it was a joy and a delight, but also incredible hard work, both physically and mentally. It was a very isolated place. Back then, we couldn't we could barely email each other, to keep in touch with my friends and my family. It would cost me like £2 to send a 3-line email. And as a student, I didn't have that kind of money. So we wrote letters. I worked with some amazing Ethiopians who helped me collect data for my research. And that work with the Ethiopian Wolf Conservation Program, it is where I learned the skills that I now want to try and teach and help equip other wildlife conservationists around the world. So it was a formative experience for me, but also a springboard, a stepping stone to where I am now. And there's a lot of different angles I could go with that. I don't know whether I should just leave you to
question. Let me jump in then, because the Serengeti Campo, it's an area that we could spend a lot of time on, but I guess if I was to push in on just one kind of area on that. And I'm glad you kind of made that joke at the start of the episode about the owl, you know, making eye contact. And it's not that you had this massive, you know, philosophical lesson, this learning moment. But what did these wolves teach you? What did that experience, what did you walk away from that 2 years gaining, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. Like them and the wolves and their behaviour themselves, it kind of gave me a view into how important family is and the keeping connections with the people that you care most about, whether you're related by blood to them or not. And that you have to put time, you have to invest energy into maintaining those relationships. And just checking in. So the wolves, they would wake up every morning far too early. I would have to creep out of my tent like an hour before dawn in the crunching frost up in the highlands, and go and try and figure out where on earth they'd fallen asleep the night before so that I could park myself behind a bush like 20 or 30 meters away, and wait for them to wake up. And when they woke, they would just like the first one get up, stretch, and then start yipping, and they would all gradually wake up. They would all come and they'd fawn over each other and lick each other and say hi and kind of build up to this group. It wasn't so much as a howl. They don't do the same kind of howls that grey wolves do, but it's kind of like a chorus, a song that they would do together that you could see was really important to them as part of their family bonding. And then they would all trot off kind of one after the other, usually led by one of the parents, the dominant male and female. They'd all trot off around the boundary to check their territory, to check what the other packs next door to them were doing, to check whether there are any dogs or any people wandering around, and see what the weather's doing, figure out where they were going to go hunting that day. And they obviously had such strong family bonds. Every now and then there'd be maybe one of the adults from a neighbouring territory would come in and chase one of the pups from this territory, and then they would all kind of be chasing around and trying to defend each other. And it was just really, I don't know, I guess I've said it already. It was just really highlighting to me that even amongst non-human species, family bonds are important, that they can communicate with each other, that they obviously have a bond of affection for each other, and that they look out for each other. So I guess that's the biggest thing that I learned from them, was the importance of maintaining those relationships with the people that you care about, that it's worth putting effort in.
It's really beautiful. Something that I would love.
It's a lovely experience.
Yeah, I mean, it just sounds, I can't wrap my head around it. Like, I'm actually a bit stunned. I'm like, oh my days. Like, I just want to read the book about it. I'm like, this is just unbelievable. I guess, like, an area of learning, one of the things I love about doing this podcast is it's just a really selfish opportunity to learn things and plug gaps of my like ignorance. And so, you know, even in the bio that you sent through, you mentioned the biodiversity crisis, and you've touched on that briefly already. So I'm just going to level with you. That's a term that I've heard quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a term I understand. So could you maybe just tell us, like, what is the biodiversity crisis and why is it a crisis?
Mm-hmm. So we're currently losing species at an incredible rate. Extinction is happening far higher rates than we've recorded through prehistory. So human activities are having such a great effect and often such a detrimental effect on the natural world that species are going extinct in their droves. And the reason why it matters, like you may not notice it in your day-to-day life. You may perhaps notice that there are fewer songbirds in the trees than you might have thought there were growing up. You may think that you don't see quite as many butterflies in the hedges or in the fields when you go out for a walk in the countryside. But in general, day to day, it's not necessarily affecting your life. But the problem with this mass extinction event is that it has a cumulative and also a partly unknown effect. So we don't know at what point there might be tipping points in which we lose sufficient species, or we lose species that have particularly important roles in our ecosystem, that certain types of agriculture might collapse. So, for example, I'm sure a lot of people have heard that there are problems with pollinators, and that numbers of pollinators and diversity of pollinators are going down. And that's beginning to have impacts in certain areas on how well crops are pollinated and on the yield of certain crops. We have a growing understanding of biodiversity and the importance of species interactions. But we don't yet know enough about individual species' roles in an ecosystem to know at what point the ecosystem stops providing the ecosystem services on which everything on Earth depends, including us humans and all of our various activities.
So, bit of a hard pivot then, but how do you go from English Midlands to Oxford University to the, you know, convenient trip then to Ethiopia to Northern Ireland? How on earth does that happen? Like, how on earth do you end up here?
That's a good question. I mean, like each one of those movements, and there was also, I spent a year in Vietnam before I went to Ethiopia. And,
oh my word.
Every one of those choices and opportunities, that they're kind of motivated by different things in my life at the time. But like to take the last one first, and we can go back further in time if you want to after that. I ended up in Northern Ireland because I have an amazing life partner who is Irish. He's from south of the border. And when he finished his last contract, we were based in Sweden for 2 years while he did a postdoc in Sweden. We decided that we would like to move closer to home. We wanted to start a family, and he looked for jobs in Dublin because we knew that we were more likely to find a work for him close to his family than to mine, because my parents live in the wilds of Shropshire and there's really not very much out there for the kind of work that we wanted to do. These days we could be anywhere, you know,
we're
all working remotely anyway. But I'm so glad that he didn't manage to find a job in Dublin. He's like, well, I'll try Belfast. And he got a job in Belfast. And so we moved to Belfast. By the time we moved, I was in the middle of my pregnancy. And so it was a really big move. So we emigrated from Sweden. I spent a few months with my family, and then we moved to Northern Ireland. And we were so happy to be here, because the more we found out about Belfast, the more we love this place. So we've lived here for 2.5 years now. And it's just such a beautiful city. Like, I love the green spaces, of course. I love the river. I love the fact that nature is not hard to get to. But it's really vibrant culturally. And it also felt like a neat compromise between England and south of the border. Sure. And I hope that's not a difficult thing anyone to hear. But it just felt that we had connections with both of our families, and there was a familiarity with the culture that was important to me, because from having lived in various places during my life, I've realised that even if you're moving to a place which you think is going to be familiar, like Sweden, it's actually very, very difficult, and it can take a long time to settle in. But we moved to Belfast, and everyone we met was so, so friendly and open and warm. And it's just been a joy to be here. We can live without a car, which was one of our goals, because it's a small city. There's some good cycle routes around. The public transport is good. We're thrilled to be here, and I can see us being here for a long time.
So how do you then, you know, you come to Belfast, you have a baby, you start a business, and then a global pandemic hits. So tell me your thoughts for starting Verdant Learn. What is it, and what are you doing? Like, what are you up to?
So one of the things I realised after my time in Ethiopia was that I could carry on doing that kind of wildlife research. I could carry on traveling to exotic places and having the luxury of working with endangered species. But that wasn't going to be the way in which I had the greatest impact in conservation. And there's also an element of post-colonialism to it, which makes me quite uncomfortable at times, in that what we really should be doing in wildlife conservation is empowering local communities to protect their own wildlife. And even saying that, a lot of communities are already empowered. They might have historic and cultural ways to protect their wildlife. They might already be managing it, but there's still very much this mindset in some people that, and I count myself among them, and I'm ashamed to say it, until recently, that we know how things should be done here in the West, and we have to go and help everyone do it that way. So I focus particularly in the tropics, because they're more biodiverse areas, and that's often where the biodiversity crisis is at its peak. But I realised that if I wanted to have an impact in conservation, then helping other people to learn to use the skills that I had built up over my years of research would be a far more effective way. So actually saving species and building people's relationship with their local environment. By taking a tool that you know is useful and putting it in the hands of somebody local so that they can then adapt it to suit their situation, it's not only is it more culturally sensitive, but it's also going to be more effective and more impactful than you going in there. So I was very aware from all my years of living overseas, I never managed to get a grip on the local language very well. And I was always going to be held back by my lack of understanding of local traditions and history and culture and politics. I was never going to be able to cooperate as well with local communities or with local, regional or national government as anyone who was born there. And so it was just really clear to me that not only was it training people was the right way to approach my impact in conservation. So I'm hoping that by running courses on the kind of skills that I see are needed to help monitor wildlife and wildlands, wildlife conservation requires a huge range of skills to be done well. And my focus is on the natural sciences side of that. So the things that I do are things like I teach people coding so that they can do statistical analyses, that they can find out answers to questions from the data that they collect in the field. So, for example, someone's thrown out cameras into the forest. They want to find out the size of the tiger population, say, in their part of the forest. And I can help them answer that question about the population size and whether it's increasing or decreasing by teaching them how to use very specific coding tools, so packages in R and Python, for those of you who know coding, that will help them, that will ingest their data, work with the assumptions they have about how those data were collected, and then give them a number at the end that tells them how the tiger population is doing, or perhaps what the threats are to it in that particular area. I also teach things like geographical information systems, GIS, so making maps, doing spatial analyses, so overlaying information on human populations, places where livestock are located, where the prey of the tiger is, where the tiger's territories are, and using all of that to understand the different effects that those different layers are having on each other. But I recognise that these kind of natural sciences skills that I'm very comfortable with are only one small part of all of the tools that a professional conservation biologist has to have in their toolkit. So you also need to understand the economic and financial drivers to conservation issues. You also need to be able to work effectively with local communities, understand how they use the land, understand how that may have changed either historically or recently, and you need to be able to work effectively with policymakers. You might need an understanding of environmental law. But I don't have any of those skills, so I'm really keen to find collaborators who can help me build up a much wider toolkit. And I should clarify that I don't expect any of the wildlife conservation professionals that I work with to gain all of these skills by themselves and one individual. It's more about trying to support people to build multidisciplinary teams so that they can tackle all of the dimensions of wildlife conservation problems as a team.
So, I mean, you mentioned the financial drivers behind conservation. Kind of crudely, talk to me about your business itself, as in, how do you make money? How do you get clients? How do you access funding? Because it's a world I can't imagine, and I don't know how on earth to navigate that as an entrepreneur. So how do you go about doing that, and what is your business, I guess?
Yeah, I haven't touched on that yet, really, have I? And those are all really interesting questions. And I have to say, I don't have the answers to all of them yet, but I'm gradually experimenting and finding my way towards them. So one of the fundamental underpinnings of Verdant Learn is that it's built on open educational principles. So my goal is to create learning materials that I then release under an open license. And that doesn't just mean that people can study them for free. It means that other educators can contribute to them, can adapt them for their own learners and their own situation, and can use them in their own courses. So I'm hoping to be in a situation where I can amplify what I do and see it evolve, see it be taken up by the community and evolve. Obviously, no money is coming into me from that. So in terms of having money to live on, to survive, so that I can continue doing this, I am layering services on top of those, that foundation of open educational courses. So I am offering tutoring services. So I occasionally run paid courses, so the people who can afford that can come and study along with 15, 20 other people and have me there as the expert to call on whenever they need help or if they want individual advice on their particular situation and how they're wanting to use the techniques that they're learning. I also want to get to a point where I can facilitate people to form learning circles. So they're not necessarily having somebody teach them, but they're finding other like-minded people who want to learn the same skills, who maybe have the same kind of background or come from the same geographic area or are trying to tackle similar conservation issues. And they can learn with them. So they kind of go through the self-study materials at the same pace as some other people. They discuss what they find. They discuss how to apply what they've learned, anything that they don't understand. So kind of finding a way that is more affordable for people to study, not by themselves. So to have other people to study with, because I strongly believe, like part of my pedagogical philosophy is that people learn together. They have to construct their own learning, and learning is best done in a community. So you learn alongside, with, and from other people.
So, I mean, kind of on that note, what has it been like for you to be a part of something like the Ulster Bank Accelerator Programme? Because, you know, there is that kind of attitude or that maybe that stereotype in your head of like what an accelerator is. And I think of like, you know, tech, like startup, like people who are like launching these like subscription-based software, you know. Mm-hmm. And then there's you who's bringing this amazing world of conservation and, you know, wildlife protection, intersecting that with the world of entrepreneurship. So what's that been like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a big challenge, and there's so much to learn. And I'm grateful to the Ulster Bank, the Climate Accelerator, because it allows me to have those people to learn from and to learn alongside. So it creates this mini community of other people who are entrepreneurs. They may be serial entrepreneurs, they may have a lot of experience, or they may be like me, just starting out with their first startup. But we can go to each other with the problems that we're dealing with, the challenges or the decisions that we have to make, and we can advise each other. I get so much value from other people's perspectives on my business, and I've definitely made changes to my business model as a result of conversations I've had, and I've had a lot of ideas and input and inspiration, and I've gained strength from the other people in this accelerator, because they understand my situation and I understand theirs, and we know that what we're doing is challenging, but we're doing it because we really want to see change in the world, and because we see that we can contribute to something, that we can contribute to tackling climate or sustainability or biodiversity issues, and help other people who may not have the specialist knowledge that we have to make those small steps that incrementally will add up to a sea change in how we relate to the natural environment and how we sit within it as human beings. Mm. So there are lots of specific workshops that I've been on that have been really eye-opening. So this morning I was on one on PR. And then there are community calls where we get together, we practice our pitches, and mine still needs a lot of work, but I'm improving it gradually. And then we kind of each take it in turns to voice a challenge and get other people's opinions and advice and ideas and clarification on what that challenge is and how we can approach it and how we can find solutions. So I have to say the biggest benefit that I'm getting out of the accelerator is just that feeling of community and that other people walking alongside with me step by step. We're all learning and building and growing together.
It's brilliant. You're the queen of like setting yourself up for the next question, by the way. Like the transitions are like ridiculously smooth here. I'm like, oh my word, people are going to think that was like heavily scripted and edited. That's class.
I mean, it's not scripted at all.
the tip of my tongue was like, you know, what has been maybe the greatest challenge that you faced on the journey so far? Because the route's never smooth, and
not at all.
There's a mountain of challenges. But if you were to cherry pick one or two,
yeah. So I think I'm my biggest challenge in many ways. I trip myself
aren't we
up.
All?
I
flip me.
Ah, oh, goodness, yeah. I make all of these decisions. Which, if you're looking at my business from a purely business perspective, like say as maybe an investor,
nuts and
who's
bolts,
very
spreadsheet,
yeah. Yeah, and also just like the reasons why I'm doing it. I'm not doing this to make a million. I'm not doing this to grow it into a huge company to sell it on to someone else. But at the same time, so I'm doing it because I want to try and make conservation learning accessible globally, regardless of people's income, regardless of their personal situation, regardless of how much time they have to learn or their educational background. But to do that, I make decisions which are not necessarily the best from a business perspective. So I decide that it's really important that my content is released openly. So a lot of people would ring fence that content and go, no one is allowed to learn from me unless they pay to get access to my learning materials. So that's a bad business decision in financial terms. But what I'm hoping is that it will turn into be a good business decision, as in the most extreme form of content marketing you've ever seen. We'll see if that works out or not. But the other huge challenge I've had is that the mindset in academia, where I've spent a lot of my previous working life, is so, so different to entrepreneurship and business in general. So I'm a scientist. I love experiments. I see the value of experiments. But the kind of experiments and research that I would do, they extend over months and years. And here I'm being asked by my entrepreneur coaches to contract that down into an experiment in a few days.
You're like, all right, we're going to do a 12-hour sprint, and by the end of the day, you're going to have...
Exactly.
And you're like, whoa, like, give me 12 years.
Exactly. No, I need to... Yeah, exactly. I need to do a bit of reading about this. I don't feel like I know that enough. I'm not an expert. And so that mindset shift has been huge for me. And it's definitely still a journey that I'm only halfway through. But I'm gradually becoming more comfortable with releasing course materials that I don't think are good enough yet. You know, that it's okay, that I've got a lot of underlying assumptions and I need to test them. And it's okay to release something which is not as good as I know the final product can be, just to get feedback on it to see whether those assumptions are valid or whether actually I'm just not approaching it from the right angle.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most valuable maxims that has kind of come out of the startup world is that done is better than perfect sort of mentality. You know, it's really, really precious. Flip side of the coin then, like, what is maybe, like, what's your most successful moment so far? Or like a proudest moment, you know, like a mountaintop experience?
Yeah. I have to say that is the most difficult question you've asked me so far. I could talk for ages on the challenges I've had and the pitfalls and the difficulties and the mistakes I've made. But
we are a product of our our aisles.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a really good question. Do you know what I'm really proud of? Is that I have come back to my values after having had a lot of advice to do things differently from a business perspective. I have come back to what I feel is going to have the greatest impact and that truly matches my ideal of removing barriers to learning. I think I've just contradicted myself in that I know that that was not necessarily a good business decision, but I would not have the same energy and passion to work on VerntLearn if it didn't align fully with the way that I believe the world should be. So it's been really eye-opening for me to go through a journey over the last year of kind of looking at my business in a different way, pivoting several times because of COVID and the challenges that that brought up, but then coming back to what I truly believe in, not approaching it in the same way, but finding ways to, yeah, I don't want to make it sound like I haven't learned anything from the last year, because I've learned so much, sure, my brain's exploded, but coming back to figure out how I can apply what I've learned while still staying true to my ideal of doing this because I want to play my part in reducing the biodiversity crisis and empowering others to do the same.
Yeah, but like, there's so much wisdom in that, because like, as you said, like the biggest challenge, like the biggest obstacle we face is ourselves. And ultimately, like, regardless of whether a decision is good or bad, like on paper, you have to do whatever it takes to get yourself in the game. You know what I mean? Like, if you make a decision that knocks you out or knocks your motivation out or knocks your drive out, well, then you've lost. So like, you know, you have to sometimes make those tough calls. And I think that's, it's a really interesting way of looking at things, actually. It's very cool.
Yeah, and I also just think that you just have to get going. And I'm in the lucky position where I can do consultancy work that is going to pay the bills. And so when it comes to Verdant Learn, I can kind of front load my effort into creating the stuff that I can then release for free. I don't have to straight away be up and running paid for courses, which obviously massively restricts the type of person who can study with me initially. So it's a complete luxury, and I'm one of those people who's in an uncomfortable position of being able to say that alongside all of the difficulties of COVID, it has opened up an avenue to me to earn money that would not have been there before. And that means that I can now devote my Verdant Learn energies to opening up the training much more widely. Yeah. So, there is a silver lining.
What's the dream here? Like, where do you see this going? Like, if you were to, you know, wave the magic wand or look into a crystal ball or whatever analogy you want to use, like, what would you love to see, I don't know, you know, in 5 or 10 years in terms of Verdant Learn?
Yeah, that's a lovely question. I would like to be working with a really wide network of collaborators, so that there is the breadth of courses and the depth of courses that would enable any conservation professional, whatever stage they are in their career, to just come in and find something that is of direct value to them right there that day for what they're trying to achieve in their day job. I would love to have my learners as my collaborators. I would love to have created a learning environment in which they feel that they can contribute their own learning to the learning materials, that they can bring in case studies, that they can make corrections where I've made inevitable mistakes, that they can make suggestions and co-create with me other learning materials, or co-create with any of my collaborators other learning materials that are going to be really tightly targeted to what they need. So my hope is not that I carry on doing this by myself, all alone, limited obviously by my time, energy, knowledge, background, worldview, but that I somehow figure out how to build a community around what I'm doing so that it stops being reliant on what I can do as an individual, and it becomes much greater than the sum of all of the people who can contribute to it.
I don't even know if this is like a valid question, but I feel like it would be a wasted opportunity if I didn't at least throw it out there.
Ask away.
Like, what could we do? Like, us everyday 9-to-5ers living in Northern Ireland, living in Belfast, doing our thing. Mm-hmm. Like, what can we do to even protect and preserve our own kind of wildlife ecosystems here at home? I know that's like a PhD sort of, you know, question where it's like, please take 4 years, 70,000 words.
The research has been done. And I just wish I had more specific like sources of information to point you to right now. But a few things off the top of my head, and maybe we can follow up with some links later. But there are loads of amazing people on Twitter and blogging and LinkedIn and in the media. There's loads of advice about little steps, little things that individual people can do that are going to help their local environment, or, you know, help the environment in the places where the goods that they buy, the things that they consume, are produced and how they're transported. So really simple things from trying to choose food items with less plastic packaging, from questioning whether you need to buy that next new outfit or whether you could get a little bit more use from something that you already own, or if not, whether you can pass it on to somebody else instead of throwing it away. In terms of biodiversity, then even small things like having plants on your window ledge, having window boxes, if you've got any outdoor space, then having plants out there. So providing feeding opportunities for pollinators, to support wild pollinator populations, having places where butterflies can lay their eggs, creating spaces where other wildlife can find a home and not be pushed out, making decisions about how you insulate or heat your home, how you spend your time just going out and being outdoors. Because right where we started, the connection with nature is something that we can all have. It's just built into our biology. But some people haven't necessarily grown up in a family or in a culture or in a place where they have access to nature. So if you get a chance today, just go outdoors, try and find somewhere green if you can. Have a listen, have a smell, see what you can see. It's springtime right now. You may not be listening to this in springtime, but it's springtime right now. And there's so much beauty coming out as all the leaves come out on the trees, as all the spring flowers come out, there's many more insects in the air. There's just so much to see and to hear and to appreciate with your other senses. So just by doing that, you build your connection with nature, and it's good for your well-being, and it might just help you, give you the energy to make one small change today that will restore and retain all of this biodiversity for generations to come.
Well, Lucy, I think that is a really lovely place to end, so I'm not going to say anything more other than just thank you so much, and I really, really enjoyed speaking to you.
You're very welcome. I've really enjoyed this opportunity. Thank you so much, Matt.
Climate of Change is a Best of Belfast production, made possible with support from Ulster Bank, who, as part of their efforts to lead the way in addressing the causes of climate change, have committed 25% of the places on their accelerator programme for climate-focused businesses. If you have a green business idea that could help save our planet, please click the link in the description of this episode to apply to the Ulster Bank Climate Accelerator before applications close on the 11th of June. Other than that, thanks so much for listening, and we hope you have a great rest of your day.